Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's November 22nd, 2015, and welcome to episode 114 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and 8-bit programming on little wearable tech. So, hello everybody, I'm Paul Agstrom, one of your co-hosts of the Retro Computing Roundtable, and joining me is, from all the way in Sweden, Jack Nutting. How are you?
Hello, Paul. I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good to have you back.
Thanks. Yeah, it's been a while. I don't know what's happened. Just life kept me busy, and I've not been on in weeks and weeks, maybe even months. I'm not sure. I don't know how to measure time anymore.
Yeah. So I guess perhaps we could say the excuse is the upcoming United States Thanksgiving holiday. I don't know, but a lot of no-shows today, so it's just us. But we'll, you know, soldier on.
We'll muddle through.
And speak of all the retro tech anyway. So let's see. Today... So there was a link that was going around somewhat recently, the title of which is The Internet of Things and the Return of 8-Bit Computing. And so I thought, you know, this might be something of a host topic, although, well, so there's an article on ZDNet with that title, which is basically just talking about the, you know, the sort of the coming of the Internet of Things and the overkill that things like Raspberry Pis and so forth are, and it sort of wonders about the possibility that maybe you know we want even dumber tech for the light bulbs that are on the internet and that sort of thing, and so that, I mean, I think the basic argument of it is essentially there's some use for this kind of tight programming knowledge that we got back from programming in the 8-bit days. And so anyway, I thought it might be worth briefly discussing. Jack, did you have, what do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, there's definitely a point to it, and I always encourage people to look into 8-bit computing. Like, specifically, if you want to learn about assembly programming, there's nothing better than doing 6502 assembly. Well, maybe Z80 also. But, I mean, because it's such an approachable and easy to grasp thing compared to, like, you can't even try and do assembling on a modern desktop CPU. It doesn't even make sense. Like, it's not meant for hand coding as much. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's a good way for people to learn about the nature of bits and bytes and how these things work at the lowest level, which you don't get if you're using a modern programming language at all, generally. So I think that it makes some sense. I don't know if it's a thing that's ever going to be really sort of a viable... I mean, it's an inroad, right? It's the gateway to something else. There aren't a lot of people who have jobs doing 8-bit software development, but, I mean, there are some. I mean, obviously, we've talked before about Western Digital. They still sell the 6502 technology, and, you know, you license it for your product design if you're making a simple toy or whatever. I mean, there are people who are working with this, but it's a pretty small number of people, I'd say. But I think it's definitely interesting. One of the things they mentioned in the article is this code bug, which I think this looks like the thing that was talked about. We talked about it sometime before in the UK. They were launching some device. It's going to be a tiny 8-bit device that they were going to be giving away to every school child in 8th or 9th grade or something. Remember this story?
I do. I didn't know it was this. But
I don't know if it is. This resembles it strongly. Like the look of the actual little circuit board with these six little rings that are easy to attach things onto. It looks like that. I don't know if it's the same thing or not. I haven't looked into it, but I don't really know. I mean, again, it's the kind of thing that I think it's very interesting for people to learn this stuff. And I'm always in favor of people learning the nuts and bolts of how programming actually works at the lowest levels, which again, you never really learn with a modern language. There are too many compilers and too many steps in the way.
Yeah. Well, and I also, to the extent that I think about this, I still have this kind of, I don't know, curmudgeonly view. It's like, kids today, you know, because you don't have to really optimize anything anymore. I mean, like, the computer just goes so fast, it really doesn't matter if you accidentally go through a loop twice as many times as you need to.
Right.
But, yeah, so I was thinking, just speculating about a course that I was considering doing in kind of like, you know, the modern world, working with statistics and computer applications in my academic field. But I was thinking that, you know, if I wanted to try to integrate my retro computing stuff, it would be kind of a nice exercise to give everyone like a 1 megahertz computer and have them try to write the thing such that it actually finishes, you know, it actually finishes running before the class ends,
right.
You know, rather than if it's going to take 3 weeks, you're not going to get this, you know, the homework will not be done in time. You have to code it tightly enough. But
this is a good idea. Yeah, you can find something that is an algorithm in a data set that, you know, there are a number of ways to do it. And if you find one of the right ways to do it, you can fit it within, you know, you can implement it and run it within an hour or two. And if you have some naive approach, it will definitely not work. That's a good idea.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I do think that there is something positive that we gained when we actually had to try to, you know, manage to fit this thing into 56, you know, bytes or whatever we had available. And that's something that you wouldn't get, even if there are cheap little Raspberry Pis or whatever that you can run some kind of device on, It's still a whole Linux,
right? Yeah, it's still a very advanced operating system with a lot of space and not a lot of constraints that are meaningful. I think in that way, like, the Arduino is closer to what we're talking about, but even that is fairly powerful compared to what we had back in the day. And even then, you're still using a fairly modern language to work with it, mm-hmm. generally. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's very interesting. When I was helping out a class at a media school here in Stockholm a year ago, I was sort of leading this group of young people who were learning about building apps and designing experiences and mobile and all kinds of things. And I was sort of teaching them kind of a programming section of the whole thing. And I started them off by doing some very kind of low-level explanations. These are all people who... they're all, you know, I'd say they're mostly in their early 20s, most of them. They're very steeped in technology. They all have, you know, cell phones and laptops and iPads and whatever, and are, you know, had their noses in their phones at the time when I was talking. But but when I talked about, like, the basics of how a CPU works, I mean, a few of them had some idea. A few of them actually had done some programming and that sort of thing. But most of them, I just, like, it was like deer in the headlights. Like, their jaws dropped. They were just had these blank stares. They just could not understand what I was telling them. It was like, okay, there's something that is lost on kids these days. Like you said, it's just an incomplete education in how this technology works because it's so easy to jump past all these steps. So I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it would be interesting if it turned out that there is a sudden new market for you know, light bulb programmers, but or whatever.
Let's
I can
hope.
Think like maybe a toaster or something. I'm not sure, you know, but some little devices I mean, one of the points that the article was making was just that even just apart from the overkill of it, you don't want a light bulb that costs $35 or whatever because you put a whole Raspberry Pi in there. There's no point in having something quite so complex. So
yep, that is true. I think one of the obstacles, though, to actually getting devices that are Internet of Things devices running on a tiny 8-bit platform is that just having any kind of networking stack takes a fair amount of RAM and CPU and that sort of thing. So I don't really know where we stand on that. I remember seeing something in the past few months about some sort of TCP/IP implementation for the 6502 that someone had working on probably an Apple II and could perhaps work on other things. But again, I mean, that is, you know, that's fairly CPU intensive to actually have that thing running probably. And I don't really know how that works on a device like that.
Well, now that's a tough problem, actually, now that you mention it. It does sort of seem like, you know, for the basics of, you know, making sure your toast is appropriately, you know, brown or whatever, you probably don't need anything too fancy, but just plain TCP/IP is expensive and complicated, and nothing anymore is going to allow for non-encrypted connections.
Right.
So you pretty much have to have an internet bit onto which you put an 8-bit, you know, processor, you know, so it's, it's, you know, it's really the internet bit has to be probably separate.
So we're looking at some sort of dual core machine. One has, like, one of the cores is really pretty fancy.
Going like a gigahertz. And
and then we have the simple core, just do the simple stuff. But then I think we've kind of lost the price advantage.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, okay. All right, maybe I need to read this article again. But, so one of the at least one of the possible candidates for the thing you might have seen recently was that the Ethernet 2 card came out for the Apple II. I forget if we talked about it here, but it's a plug-in card that, you know, has an Ethernet jack on it and some sort of, you know, I'm not actually sure exactly what it does internally, but I think it handles a lot of the protocol stuff on its own.
Mm-hmm.
The TCP/IP stuff. So it's a, you know, like you can use it as a way to communicate onto the net, but it's, you know, it's handling a lot of the hard work.
Right. I wonder if it actually has another processor on the board to deal with some of that stuff.
Okay. Ethernet 2.
And I think this is exactly what the thing that I remember hearing about. You mentioned the name again.
Yeah.
I recognize it. So, but yeah, I don't know how it works.
I have two of them, actually. They finally, you know, they came out and they were shipped, and I have them in there waiting. I got two so that I could, you know, at least have some kind of two-way communication.
Right.
But then I haven't opened it yet, so I don't know. But okay. Anyway, so we'll see how our you know, what happens in this small programming space.
But right.
I don't know. There's some optimism that all of this. All of this brain space that's being filled up with like 6502 opcodes, you know, isn't completely going to go to waste.
Should be useful somehow, someday.
Yeah.
There are stories now and then about, oh, well, you know, such and such company has to, you know, hire some consultant who's an old guy in his 80s because he's the last person alive who knows how to program this system from the 1950s or whatever. I mean, there, you know, those stories appear now and then.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You never know when someone's going to, you know, you'll get the call one day, Mr. Hagstrom.
That's right.
I think you have some skills we need here. We're going to have to bring you in.
It's quite possible that I don't have unique skills that way, but I do know that, like, I remember thinking, like, yeah, you know, a decade ago or something, like, why do I know that LDA immediate is A9? I mean, like, I will forever know this. You know, the speaker clicks when I hit CO3O. But anyway.
Yeah, good stuff.
Okay, so let's see. So I guess maybe that's enough of the host topic for now. We got a couple of listener feedback links that we got along the way that I'll mention. One of them actually was the thing we just talked about, the Return of 8-Bit Computing article, which a couple people sent us. Scott sent us a link to a little, it's like a 20-minute documentary about, it's actually sort of an interview and then with Ken Olson, who is co-founder of DEC, and then kind of an overview of the company's founding. It seems pretty interesting. I hadn't seen it before. I think it was posted quite a while ago, but so if you haven't seen it, it's worth taking a look at. Jack, did you happen to look at it?
I did not, but I will.
Yeah, I pretty much was listening to it in the background more than watching it, but it seemed pretty interesting, and it kind of covered, you know, from the beginning, when they were sort of like formulating the PDP, up through, you know, the VAX era.
Cool.
So let's see. And then, Tony sent a link to, something, and, you know, a little list of, 10 computers that time forgot. And, you know, so this is one of those lists of, you know, clickbait type lists. But it was, you know, so whatever, who cares about the content? It was kind of neat to see the pictures of them and to sort of count, you know, like how many of these do I have? But,
well, I can say I don't have any of those. I used to have an Amiga a long time ago, but yeah, that was sort of the weird thing too. Like some of the things included in the list are sort of, well, like the Amiga, they include the Amiga, and the first sentence is, the Commodore Amiga is fondly remembered by many. Well, wait, I thought we were talking about computers that time forgot.
So time forgot it, but many remember.
And they also included the Vectrex video game system, which was not a home computer in any sense at all. It's a video game system.
And also not really forgotten.
No, really not forgotten. I don't know.
Yeah, so let's see. The list includes the Epson HX20, which I do have not played with. I think it's not, you know, it's a little laptop. It's like a precursor to the PX8. Little thing you can basically word process on.
Yeah, I'd never seen that before. It's kind of cool. It has a little printer and the tiny microcassette storage and
I think those are modular too. Like I think you can put something in at least in place of where that cassette is. Although I don't know what else you can put there. But the HX20 actually, I think, also has a... You can put a little, like, sidecar on it with extra stuff. Okay. So I think these were used for, you know, going out and diagnosing equipment and things like that. Mm-hmm. Jupiter Ace is impossible to find. Little fourth computer.
A friend of mine is a Jupiter Ace enthusiast. He actually made he's made the emulator for the iPad for the Jupiter Ace. Including the manual, so you can sort of swipe and bring up the whole scanned in manual or something like that. Pretty crazy.
Is that something do you have to jailbreak to use it?
No. Nice. I don't know how we got around that. We'll link to it in the show notes. Okay. I don't remember exactly what it's called, but it's cool.
Yeah, I don't really know what the App Store restrictions are. I mean, I know that you're not supposed to be able to put things you can program in there somehow, but I know that there's a C64 basic interpreter in there somewhere, I think, and yeah, I don't really know where the division is.
It's slightly fuzzy, but there are things like if you're going to have any kind of interpreted code that could potentially be fetched from the internet, that can only be interpreted through the JavaScript engine included in Safari and iOS, basically. But when it comes to things like an emulator with ROMs, it seems like because those are not really interpreted in the same exact way, it's okay. But I think like if it would be different if you can buy a pack, an emulator that has a bunch of ROMs in it that are sort of a known quantity, then that's okay. But if there were a thing where you could actually sort of create your own stuff and add in there or download ROMs from random sources off the internet, that would somehow not be okay. I think that's kind of where they draw the line.
Yeah, because I know that MAME emulation is notoriously hard to keep on there. People keep, you know, like people will hide it behind some other app.
Right.
You know, it's like a Compass app or something. But, and I think that there's a 2GS emulator. I don't know if it's still out there, but basically a Gridly, that was what it was. And
right,
actually, maybe that's a MAME emulator. But, you know, it's packaged as a single game, but it actually is powered by an entire emulator that you can, you know, if you just go into the file system, you can change the image it runs.
Right.
Yeah, anyway, so yeah, most of these, so I guess we only made it through a couple of them, but the Vectrex, Sinclair QL, Amstrad, PCW, actually, I mean, I've heard of Sinclair and I've heard of Amstrad. I've heard of the QL, I suppose, but I don't know this Amstrad.
Yeah, I don't know the one either.
So, yeah, maybe time forgot. This is BT, also, so it's kind of British focused.
Right.
But, yeah, so maybe that's why they forgot the Vectrex.
Yeah. It's forgotten in England.
Okay, let's see. And I guess that is enough for the listener feedback. So now we can move on to items of interest and news. And so the first one is sort of a sad note. There's the New York Times has published an obituary that. So they say that Gene Amdahl, pioneer of mainframe computing, dies at 92, and he. They leads off saying he is a trailblazer in the design of IBM's mainframe computers, and they go on. You know, it's a fairly nice article. It's unfortunately I know the Amdahl name, but I didn't know the history. The New York Times article is fairly extensive, sort of like documenting how he kind of went through up until sort of like, you know, working with the 360 and so forth, System 360. And there's also on the computerhistory.org site, there is a nice interview done by Bill Asprey in September 2000. Mm-hmm. So, and I haven't actually read through this, but it's quite long. So, I will read through it. I think it would be interesting to do. I kind of wish, clearly he was important, but I wish I knew more about him before having, discovered this news.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. It's a name that I feel like I know well, but also did not know much about the guy really. And so that, like I said, the New York Times article was nice because it had sort of a list of the various things he did, both, you know, before joining IBM and after. So it was a good read and an interesting story about a guy who, unfortunately, neither of us had knew much about.
The one reason that I wasn't sure whether everybody had heard of, you know, heard of Amdahl really was that my mother at some point worked for Amdahl, like the company.
Okay.
I'm to be honest, you'd think I would know, but I'm not actually sure exactly what her connection was. It might have been sort of as external consultant, but I know that there was at least a period of time when she was doing sort of like mainframe security stuff with Amdahl. Anyway, so yes, that's sad news, I guess, you know, sort of following up on the sad news we reported last time too. So I guess this is going to be coming. Maybe we should spin off a separate podcast for that. the obituaries. But well, hopefully there will be no need, but at some point there.
Never again will any of our industry's heroes die.
Yes, I'm putting my foot down here.
This must stop.
Yes, we'll put a petition up on one of those petition sites. But, okay, well, anyway, Jack, you have a Kickstarter.
Yeah, I'll pull the next one here. This is something I found. A thing called the Polycade, the Retro Arcade of the Future. It's a Kickstarter started by a couple of Nolan Bushnell's sons, Tyler and Dylan, and a guy called Charles Carden. I don't know whose son he is. Mr. Carden's son, I guess. And they're making this cool-looking thing called the Polycade. It's an arcade cabinet powered by a Raspberry Pi with a nice big screen that you basically install. You mount it on a wall, so it has no floor footprint whatsoever. It sticks out from the wall about a foot or a foot and a half, but that's it. And again, it has a nice big screen. I don't know what it is, 20 inch roughly, I would say. And it has two sets of 8-way controls and 6 buttons and a 4-way control and a couple buttons. So it's kind of like a nice looking MAME cabinet type of deal. And just the way that it's designed to be a thing that you stand up in front of like you would an arcade, but doesn't take up a whole lot of space like an actual arcade cabinet would. And because it is a Raspberry Pi powered thing, you can basically install whatever. They say that it's going to come with a certain sort of set of things. Like, I guess they're working on a particular image to boot up on the Raspberry Pi inside of it. And they have already hit their goal. Their goal was only $20,000, a very, very small goal, and they've already passed that. There are 24 days to go, though, so you can still back it, and there are deals for either buying the Polycade at the, like, pre-release price, or you can sort of get other rewards if you sign up for other swag. There are t-shirts and things like that. One of the rewards is an Atari 2600 cartridge signed by Nolan Bushnell.
Cool.
So, looks interesting. It's kind of pricey. It's nothing that I'm going to buy for sure, just because, like, I have kids. I can't afford to, like, I can't afford to drop $2,000 on a game machine like this exactly. So, I won't buy it. But somebody should, because it's pretty cool.
It's, you know, right, like a $2,000 Raspberry Pi enclosure, basically.
But, okay, well, the TV, the screen is actually a 28-inch TV. So, I mean, it's not an inconsequential thing. So, you know, that would cost a few hundred bucks by itself, just the TV. So it's not totally off the charts. I assume that the joysticks are pretty nice. I don't know what the details are I'm not enough of a joystick nerd to even know if they show the details if those are really good joysticks. They look like arcade joysticks that look decent. I don't know.
It seems like if you were sort of serious about making a MAME cabinet, you probably would have been thinking something along these lines anyway, as far as price goes. So,
right.
I don't know. Yeah, it looks a little bit like an ATM in your house.
Yeah.
But I wonder how it's mounted. Maybe it isn't actually all that heavy. But I think it would be kind of neat to have such a thing and not have it. You know, it's sort of like making an arcade cabinet that you stand in front of, but it's somehow like pushed into the wall, so
right.
you can pretend, even though it actually is just flat ish. Yeah, I like it. I like it. Yep. I would not turn it away if it were given to me, but I think I probably won't buy one.
Yep, same here.
I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just saying.
This should have been the host gift idea. Someone.
Oh, yeah, right, exactly. Gifts for the hosts.
That's what we need. One of the things you could sign up for, one of the pledges was for $2,600, I think, you get two Polycades.
Right.
Huh? How about that? Two.
So I wonder if you can. It has a couple of joysticks in it, right?
It has three.
Like, you could conceivably. Okay, so you could do something like Gauntlet or, you know, one of these games where you have multiple players.
Yeah, you can sure do two players. So it's designed to have, like, it has a four-way joystick that's in the middle for things like Pac-Man or whatever that are strictly four-way games. And then on each side, there's an eight-way joystick with six buttons. So for fighting games and that kind of thing, it'll work just fine, too. Or I guess any sort of two-player side-by-side game should work just fine. And they have a list of, like, 100-ish games that they say are included, which I guess means that they've at least tested and make sure they're configured right for the joysticks and all that stuff. So
cool. Yep. All right. We shall see how that, it'd be interesting to know if anyone winds up getting one.
And yep.
Let us know. But, okay, let's see. So I will move on to, something. This was not recently going around the links and stuff, but I had saved it. Hadn't talked about it before. Where is it? It is at, I don't know where it is. Russia Beyond the Headlines is the website it's at, and it's called Before the Internet, Top 11 Soviet PCs. And I think it's actually pretty cool. It's you know, I think we've seen some of these go by in like the eBay auctions and so forth, with just the various, like many of these are Sinclair clones, but they're really interesting looking. Yeah, they're not all just sort of uninteresting beige, you know, box things. They are some of them kind of colorful, some of them made of wood, you know.
One seems to have a light pen attached and even has like a little sort of slot to hold light pen on the keyboard
and a wiring diagram, like this is how you plug it in.
Yes. So in case you don't know how to plug your computer into a TV. Yeah, this is pretty cool. I like the there's one glamour shot posed with a tomato sitting on top of the keyboard. Hard to know why. Yeah, this is great. I love the one of them is bright red, like Ferrari red. It's fantastic. So these are nice things to look at, for sure.
Yeah, I think it would be kind of fun to have such a thing if I had like a whole separate room to put everything in, but. Anyway, whatever. I thought it was cool, and since I skipped it before, I thought I would bring it back up again.
Yep.
I'll head back to you. And so you have. Speaking of what we were speaking of before, you can keep talking about those topics.
Yeah. So this is something interesting. Someone has the classic arcade game Gauntlet, which you mentioned. Someone has kind of, in a way, ported that to the Atari 2600. I'm saying port in quotes. So what they actually did is, so the game Gauntlet was originally inspired by an earlier game called Dandy, which was a game that a third party put out for the Atari computers. So Dandy came out first, and Gauntlet came out sometime after. And the story that I've heard, this may be apocryphal, I don't know if it's true or not, is that the author of Dandy actually came to Atari when they published Gauntlet, came out with Gauntlet, and said, "Hey, this is a lot like my game Gandy. I think you kind of stole this from me." And supposedly, as compensation, he got an instance of the arcade game Gauntlet, and that was good enough for him. So anyway, so Gauntlet came out, and someone also, Atari released a game for the Atari computers called Dark Chambers, which was kind of similar to Gauntlet. What someone has done now is they've taken Dark Chambers and hacked it up to resemble Gauntlet, which is kind of cool. So they like they've updated the character sprites and colors and the way things work as well to make it look and play more like Gauntlet. I haven't tried it out yet, but it looks pretty cool. I have played, and this is for the Atari 2600. I have played, I believe, Dark Chambers for the Atari 8-bit computers, but not for the 2600. So I don't really know, but it looks kind of nice. It looks unusually bright and colorful, and like nice multicolored sprites, considering that it's an Atari 2600 game. So worth checking out and firing up in your handy emulator.
Yeah, I'll have to try that out. I just sort of on a whim, I think I was getting something else from an eBay seller, and you know, this is among the things that were there. It's an Atari joystick, except it has like a composite out and an audio out, and it's inside of it. It has 10 games. Like, there's no machine. It is just in the joystick.
Right. Yeah. I've seen some of those on eBay also.
Yeah. So, I mean, normally I wouldn't get such a thing, except that it was like $5 or something. It was, you know, sort of nothing. And I was getting other stuff shipped, so I thought I would try it out. And there was no indication of what was going to be on there.
Okay.
And it turns out, actually, and now I can't even remember what's on there. Yar's Revenge is on there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's other things by that same company. So whoever made that.
Well, Atari made Yar's Revenge.
That was a, did that they?
Was
okay.
A, yeah, that was a fair game.
So I wonder, I think there was something that was sort of theming them, but I know there was some sort of Missile Command kind of game. Maybe mm-hmm. Is it Missile Command? Is that what it's called?
It could be called that.
And Asteroids. But anyway, there were only 10, and I thought it was a little disappointing that they didn't fit more in there, but it was still kind of cool to actually play it. I don't get my 2600 out very frequently. I mean, it's kind of tucked away on a shelf. I don't much either.
I have one tucked away. I think it's actually in my garage. But like, I think with a modern TV and that kind of crappy RF output, like I can't really be bothered. I'd rather just fire up an emulator, honestly, on my Mac, and I'm happy with that. So.
But it was interesting to see kind of, you know, the blockiness again.
Like, yeah.
It's like, wow, we really, you know, I used to play Asteroids quite a lot, and this is pretty awful.
Yeah. Our imaginations filled in the blockiness. Yeah. We compensated. We overcompensated.
Right. Okay, let's see. So one thing that I forgot to mention last time was that the CFFA 3000 card for the Apple II has entered Run 4, and there were 500 made, and I think as of now there are 120 left. So actually it was quite amazing. Right when it became available, it went down to like 250 almost immediately. I mean, these things sold incredibly fast. I think now the last, it's been sitting at, you know, a little over 100 left for a while, but it always astounds me that there are that many people out there that are willing to pay, you know, $160 for this. I mean, like, there's the Apple II community is much bigger than I think, I guess, somehow.
So, Paul, you need to fill me in. What is this thing?
Yeah, I probably should say something about this.
I have no idea what this is.
It is basically the best interface card you can get for the Apple II. But what it is, essentially what it is a CF card hard drive kind of thing. It's a disk emulator, hard drive emulator, and it also has a USB connection. So you can download, you know, disk images off the internet and put them on a USB stick or on a CF card and just boot from it. The CFFA 3000 is one of the newer, you know, it's a newer revision of an earlier card. This one has in it the ability to actually like emulate a disk drive. So as long as it isn't a protected disk image, you can just boot right from it.
Okay. Nice.
So, in its firmware, it has the ability to make images of real disks and make real disks from images and, It's basically the best of its kind, and so this is the fourth run of those. I mean, like, I don't know if the previous ones were 500, but there was a certain amount of pent up demand for these.
Right.
So they're $160 plus whatever shipping is.
This, I guess, is a lot like the Atari equivalent is the SAO to SD
right,
hardware.
Right.
Yeah. Same type of thing. Cool.
Yeah. In fact, I was looking around a little bit for these. I have yet to get an Atari computer really sort of set up. I have pieces, but I think I need to glue some of those pieces back together. But I think I saw one that was actually in the cable, you know, so like you can get a, I think it was an SIO to, well, it was maybe SIO to PC. Maybe that's not the same thing. You know, that you can actually plug in like a USB on one side and an Atari SIO cable on the other, with a little circuit board inside.
Yeah, that's the SAO to PC, I think it's called. It has a USB adapter. The thing that I have the SAO to SD, which is basically you plug it into an SAO port on the computer, and it's just a little box that has some buttons and an SD card slot, and that's it. And similarly, it has firmware that lets you sort of do some stuff with disk images and that sort of thing. It has some kind of built-in boot-up program, which you can also replace with newer versions by putting it in the right directory, giving it the right name or something like that. And then it sort of boots up, and that built-in boot program kind of lets you pick from the disk images that you have with an on-screen menu. And then you choose that, and it somehow reboots into that. I don't know exactly how it works. Kind of cool, though. I mean, it's you know, we've talked about this before. It's great to have that and not to worry about all these floppies.
Right. I mean, the floppies will not only die, but it's just slow going.
Yeah.
To load everything off those. Yeah, it took me, it was only just, probably a month or two ago at most that I finally got an Atari floppy drive. You know, I have three Atari 800s. None of them are actually fully intact. and all three were intact when they were sent. It's really just very frustrating.
Weird. What is the nature of things that have happened to them to make them non-intact?
Oh, well, you know, they bounce around in the box that was not well padded inside.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, many keys fall off and things.
All right.
You know, actually, it's surprising how open the space is in there. I mean, it's just air inside, and so all it takes is just a little pressure and the thing cracks.
Okay.
But
interesting.
Anyway, so at some point I'll get these, but I do have, I finally got a disk drive. I don't know what made me say that. Now I need some disks. Oh, I need some cartridges too. I think I might have like one cartridge for the Atari 800. But
cartridges are good. I don't have a disk drive. I used to back in the day, but I don't have one. Of all of us on this show, I am the one who's least a collector of old hardware. I just have a little bit of stuff. It's almost all just old Atari stuff. And for my 8-bit Atari, I don't even have a floppy drive. I just have the SD card adapter. And that is just so much more satisfying than using floppies ever was that I just don't even care. Like if I had old floppies lying around that I wanted to convert, then of course I'd want to have a floppy drive. But I don't have any. I think there actually are some tucked away at my dad's house somewhere that I might find one day. But when I find those, I will also find his old 1050 floppy drive, I'm sure, with those things. So I'll be saved.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that I recall from, you know, my Apple II floppies was the, you know, like the sound that the floppy would make. And I'm not sure actually how copy protection worked on the Atari. I thought that the Atari drives smart? Ones are smart.
The Atari drives are also smart. But I think the way copy protection worked was, I think, often generally the same. Like, you would have sectors that were intentionally recorded in kind of a bad way so that it wouldn't be able to read it properly. So I think a lot of those things had kind of similar ideas. And so, yeah, the Atari drives also had some of this kind of noise factor when you would be encountering bad sectors and that sort of thing as part of the copy protection. But I think on the Atari, the more characteristic noise actually is noise that comes out over the speaker while it's loading. It was kind of an automatic side effect of the chipset, it seemed. It could be turned off. Like a program could start up something that would turn off that noise, but typically, it didn't happen. Typically, it was just on. So while you're loading the disk, it's always going, And on the but it's a nice little sound, and I think probably Atari computer users from that time have the same warm feeling about that Apple II users might have about their floppy drives going.
Yeah, I mean, what had made me think about that, and you know, specifically about like which drives are smart and which ones aren't, is just that you know, the Apple II had a quite early disk drive, and they saved a lot of money by basically controlling the whole thing from the computer. The 6502 inside the Apple II controlled everything about the drive. Like you turn on and off the little magnets to move the stepper motor, you know, the drive head up and down.
Right.
And so. What that means, though, is that you had total control over it, and so, you know, a lot of the copy protection really had to do with, like, reading when you put two magnets on and make the head hover in between them, and, you know, all this weird stuff. And so you actually had really kind of interesting-sounding boot processes, you know, like Choplifter, right. Booted in a particular way because it would sort of, like, run the arm quickly down the thing.
Right.
So those are the things that you kind of lose with the SD card solutions.
Right. But,
what we need is a speaker.
The thing I was going to say is that, so on the Atari, if you're using an SD card solution, it does make the same noise. It's just faster. It's kind of cool.
Oh, that's cool.
It's still making the same. Like, I think it's just it's some built-in function of the, I think it's, I want to say it's the Pokey chip that, I mean, the Pokey chip definitely makes a sound, and I think it also controls some of what happens on the SAO port. Mm. And just when data's coming in, it just beeps at you a little bit.
Cool.
Anyway, and now I know what the CFFA 3000 is. Thank you.
It's a compact flash for Apple 3000, I guess. The previous one was called CFFA 2, which was compact flash for the Apple 2. Okay. And the guy makes a CFFA 1, which is a similar card, but for the Apple 1. Relatively small market there.
Yeah.
It does. It does work on the replica one. So I have one of these cards, and I really don't think I would use the replica one for anything if I didn't. I mean, I don't really anyway. But I mean, if I didn't have this, you know, then I am only interested in typing in, you know, 20 pages of opcodes once.
Yeah. Let's not do that again.
Okay, I guess the only one other thing that I wanted to mention quickly was that the VCF East, Vintage Computer Festival East 11, has its dates have been announced. It's Friday to Sunday, April 14th to 17th, 2016, in Wall, New Jersey, at the InfoAge Science Center. So if you were trying to plan ahead, and then they do have, so as far as I know, the only guest, you know, only speaker that's been announced so far is Stuart Chaffee from who was on the what the heck is it called? Computer Chronicles.
Mm.
So that's actually kind of neat. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to make it. It's close enough to me that it's kind of embarrassing if I don't go, but right. I have yet to go. I've been to the InfoAge Center once, but I have not actually been to the VCF East.
Well, you should go and let us know what it's like.
And Jack, if you go and I don't, it will be extra embarrassing.
Everyone will be surprised. Yeah. So, where is this actually?
It's in New Jersey, sort of on the shore. So they actually had to cancel once due to, you know, hurricanes going through. it's a place that I actually have gone with some regularity, you know, nearby there for like family vacations. We would go every once in a while to the Jersey Shore.
Right.
And, you know, so a couple of years ago, we went and I said, all right, I'm driving north for a little while and going to see this museum, which I did. So,
okay, cool.
Okay. I think that's probably well enough for the news and information section. So now a word from our sponsor.
This is an ordinary TV video game. This is Vectrex, the only video game system with its own video screen. Take it anywhere. Just plug it in. It's your own personal arcade. A high-performance system with a built-in game plus a whole collection of arcade cartridges like Scramble, Pole Position, Berserk. So if you're in into video games, forget the TV. Get into Vectrex. Light 10 and 3D imager available.
And we're back. At this point, it is time for the retro computing gift idea. And so what I've suggested here is a codebug kit, a codebug wearable board. Now, these things you can get from a number of different places. So Element 14 will ship in the UK. I've got a link to Newark, which ships within the USA. But like the Raspberry Pi, there are a number of places that you can get these. But what they are is this, you know, this little board that we were talking about before. It's a little insect-looking thing. They actually don't cost very much. $20 is what this little board will cost me, at least, in the US. And the board has... you can plug it into a Raspberry Pi if you want as an add-on. But I think it has a PIC controller on it, I think, that you can program, but it has a very small space. Anyway, this is the thing we were talking about before. So if you want to practice your 8-bit computing, this is how to do it. Or if you want to suggest to someone subtly that they should practice their programming,
use send this off to them. I see on the page you linked to on Newark.com, it says, ideal for social media and Minecraft notifications. And that's perfect for me, because I always miss my Minecraft notifications. No, I don't, honestly. I don't know what that would be. What would a Minecraft notification be? I mean, I played the game, but, like, I don't know.
Seems weird. No, I think that came up last time, that, like, I have installed the game, and I cannot control the little guy, and I end up just digging a hole I can't get out of. So my notification is, you know, like, the hole around you is eroding and you're going to drown or something.
You are stuck in the hole. Yeah. You're still stuck in the hole.
But anyway, yeah, I kind of like this thing. I think I might consider getting one just to add to the other pile of products I have. But it seems like it would be kind of a cool thing to do. And it's not retro exactly, but it's retro enough.
It builds around these topics that we've been talking on and off all this episode here. So
yeah, and so actually maybe this is the time to insert the new bit of information that I got. The Ethernet 2 that I was talking about before has on it a specific chip for Ethernet. So it's a W5100, and I don't know what they cost. But the Ethernet 2 itself. Oh yeah, I guess we did talk about this before, because the card, the whole card that you put in the Apple II is only like $70. So the W5100 must be quite cheap in bulk.
Interesting.
On to further spending. I have a couple of eBay auctions, nothing too themed here, I guess. But okay, so the first one I have found is a set of three Microflight Atari joysticks for A2 FS2 flight simulator. So, you know, like, I don't know if the description is correct, but they do seem to be flight simulator related, you know, specialized joysticks. So it's a joystick with a reset button and throttle and flaps up and down, and a gun brakes button.
Right. Yeah. I looked at this too, and I think it probably is more or less what it says it is. I mean, this is not an Atari branded thing. It's related to whoever the company was that made this flight simulator. I guess they made these joysticks to go along with it. And the joysticks kind of look like what I remember typical Apple II joysticks looking like. But I can see on the back that one of them, like in the upper right corner, I see definitely the 9-pin Atari plug back there. So on the Atari, you had the normal joysticks were just sort of digital on off four directions, but you could also plug in paddles, and the paddles were, you know, they were more or less analog. And so this is probably the stick works like the Apple joystick, in that little, each of the X and Y directions maps to one of the paddle inputs on the Atari. And then, the various buttons probably map to the up, down, left, right, and fire buttons.
Interesting. So. Yeah. Cool. Yeah.
So just, you know, so most Atari games just didn't work that way. Most Atari games just use the normal joystick input, unless they were, you know, a paddle based game. But Atari never themselves shipped a joystick that worked the way the Apple II joysticks worked. So, but this looks like it probably was exactly that.
Interesting. Yeah. The so it looks like this seems to have been made by Microcube Corp. So not actually Sublogic itself, but the disc is, you know, it's the joystick, it has the joystick driver for the A2 FS2. And there are three of them, but they're being sold together. So if you want this, then you may wind up with all of them rather than... It does seem like it's kind of a neat thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely if you wanted to, you know, for a flight simulator, you definitely want to have that control, you know, versus the standard Atari controller. So it's cool.
Yeah. Starting bid is 25, and it's in Quebec, Canada. So the shipping to me is actually fairly expensive. But if you happen to also, if you're in Montreal, then let's just go get it. But
if you're anywhere in Canada, just go pick it up. Canada's not very big, so you just go there.
That's right. That's right.
You just walk over there, eh?
Right. just take the dog sled. Yeah, actually, I got another thing that I had gotten sort of somewhat recently was something kind of similar to this for the Apple II. It was specifically for a remote control airplane flight simulator. You know, the joystick itself is kind of set up like a real remote control plane joystick. You know, so it was like a dual joystick thing with a couple of different controls, and I don't know exactly how it worked, but it was specific to a radio controlled flight simulator. So I thought it was just sort of like strange, and there probably weren't many of them. So I thought I'd just go ahead and get it and see how it worked.
But mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's see the next one, a little bit mysterious. But okay, so it's a Sinclair ZX Spectrum Plus. It has a box. It has the power adapter and looks like all the cables. I don't know very much about the ZX Spectrum Plus, but it's starting quite cheap. So it's starting at £1. It has no bids so far. So to me, shipping is a lot. So shipping is, I guess, translated about like $75. But so that's probably wouldn't go myself much higher than that. But if you're somewhere where the shipping is cheaper, this might be worth looking at if you're looking for a Spectrum.
Yeah, here to Sweden, it's also showing the shipping is 50 British pounds. So it's a lot. That's a lot of shipping for a little thing.
Maybe what you want to do is buy this if you're actually in the UK.
Right. But I like that they do show a photo of this thing plugged into what looks like a quite new flat screen LED TV, and you can see the logo at the bottom. So, I mean, it seems like it produces a decent quality picture even on a newish device. So that's kind of cool. Nice that they actually showed that.
Yeah, and it's, if you read the description, the person who's selling it barely knows anything about this thing.
Yeah.
You know, he plugged it in, says, yeah. So the picture was included, and we can tell that it works.
Right.
Because, you know, we look at that and say, that's probably what I would have expected. But anyway, so worth looking at. I would sort of like to get one of these, but not. I don't think I really want to pay that kind of shipping right now.
No.
So if someone near me ends up selling one, maybe I'll get one.
Yeah.
All right, so next up I have iMac G4 Cube. And the main thing that was notable about this is just that, you know, it's a G4 Cube, and its starting bid is like $18. So it's super cheap. It's, you know, so it might, you know, might actually be worth bidding on. And one thing that I was remarking on about this, though, is it says, it says Apple Power Macintosh 500 Cube, part number, powers on, you know, whatever. And the right. Powers on part is the part that I am a little suspicious of, because the thing about the Cube, I have a Cube. And well, like I got it quite a bit before I could actually use the thing, because it takes a special power adapter that I did not have. So
yeah.
I had to spend quite a bit of time looking and quite a bit of money to buy the power supply for it. And it does not appear to be included.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, they don't show a picture of it anyway, do they?
No, no. I mean, so it's possible. I have no idea. So this is being sold by SF Goodwill Recompute. So, you know, it's a Goodwill store probably in, I guess, so that would be San Francisco, right? And they might well have what they need to actually test this, and, you know, they may well have truly discovered that it will work. It will power on, but I'm a little suspicious because the power supply isn't included. And if you're bidding on this, just know that you will also need to get the power supply for it.
Right. Actually, looking at the very last photo in the set of photos, you can see that there is some kind of red LED glow from the inside. So they took a photo of some ports with it apparently turned on.
Interesting.
So it looks like it actually is working. I don't know why they don't show the power supply anywhere else, but it looks like they took a picture of it with the power supply plugged in and up and running.
What? Unless they took a picture of it like on the grill or something. Yeah. I can't quite tell if that light is coming from inside, where that light is coming from. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Because I think what we're looking at there is at the bottom, so I am not sure. Well, anyway, if it's regardless, I mean these things are they're pretty, so you can.
They're really neat. I really love this design. Is yours working now? The one you have? So you have one. It took a while to get the power supply.
Yeah. It works, and actually, I was pretty impressed at how fast it is. I mean, like it really feels. It runs macOS 9, but it feels pretty fast. So
yeah. Because the problem I remember with these things, I never had one personally, but we had some at the place I worked at the time that these were new. And I remember that we've had problems with the power button. Like, it would sometimes, the computer would act as if the power button had been pressed, which meant it would just go to sleep. Uh-huh. And I think the problem actually was, like, there was some faultiness in the button, because the power button on this is under the plastic, so you never actually touch the button. You're touching this plexiglass, and somehow it's picking it up through that. And like, there's just something weird in that mechanism that can go wrong on a lot of these. That's what I remember.
Yeah, I think I've heard that as well. I mean, I'm not experiencing it with the one that I have, but I mean, who knows if I will. I think I thought it was somehow like sensing some change in the magnetic field or something. I mean, like it's some weird proximity detector.
Yeah, or if it's maybe some sort of capacitive touch thing like the screens we all have nowadays on our phones. Yeah. I don't really know. But I just remember that it was problematic, and there were a number of these that we had to have fixed because they would just go to sleep. And the problem actually was that button, and they would actually replace something, and it would be okay. That's what I remember.
So. Well, hopefully all the ones that are sort of left out there, you know, seen on eBay, or either the ones that failed to get thrown away because they continued to work or got fixed.
Yeah.
So
hopefully. Probably hard to get it fixed at your Apple Repair Center now.
Right. Yeah. But unfortunately, they're also not quite old enough to be comical to bring in, you know, like it'd be sort of amusing to bring in an Apple III or a Lisa or something like that and say, like, this isn't working. Can you help? But.
Yep.
Okay. And let's see. The last thing I wanted to mention is there's a Apple Interactive Television box that is listed, and it's starting. So I don't know what it has a reserve, and I don't know what that is going to be. It starts at 99 cents, which of course is very cheap for such a thing. And right. So they look kind of nice. I think, well, I mean, this one's, it's a little scratched up. I think maybe mostly they all are. And these things, I don't know if we've talked about them before. We must have, but it's basically a decorative thing, you know, kind of looks right. Like a Next, I suppose. But it has a little Apple on it. It's supposed to be like a cable box. You know, it's a cable receiver. But what it is a little, you know, it's a Pizza Box Mac essentially that has a video card in it. It's the case is not like any other case. It's sort of, you know, flat black thing with an Apple logo in the middle, and right. It inside it is some form of LC, I think.
Okay.
But
And it's basically supposed to be kind of like a set-top box, right? Because it has both an RF out and an RF in. So like the idea being this, you would have this as like a cable box, and cable signal comes in, plus the computer can overlay stuff on it or replace it with a different signal or whatever. Right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it has in it a TV tuner like the Mac TV did, or, mm-hmm. you know, just like, you know, it can send the TV signal out, or it can send like a Mac screen.
Okay.
So the thing about these is, for a long time I thought that actually nobody had ever gotten one to work, mm-hmm. but which doesn't make much sense, because actually I think Disneyland or something had a bunch of these installed at one point, so they must have been out there working, but it was very short lived. It was only sort of like a beta program, and you know, essentially it's very difficult to get these things to boot. They want to pull something off the network, you know, mm-hmm. and of course there is no network anymore.
Right.
So So I have one. I have not gotten it to do anything at all. But I've seen people who have, and so at some point I would like to, you know, try. There's a little SCSI port on the back, so it's conceivable that you can boot it off something. But anyway, so you can buy it now for $200. I think that's probably too much. But
yeah, I'm curious what the reserve is. And actually, I'm always curious about why someone puts something up for auction with a starting bid that is less than the reserve. Like, I don't understand. I guess I'm not a very good, knowledgeable, tactical auction person. Like, I don't understand. If your minimum price is $50, why don't you just start it at $50? Like, why? Do you know why? You're looking at you more than I do. No.
How about you listening in your earbuds?
Maybe you know.
I mean, I guess my guess on this is that you get sort of psychologically invested if you have bid, you know, so even if you haven't actually reached the reserve, if you put down $5 and it says, you know, you haven't reached the reserve, it'll still notify you when it's getting close to over, and you sort of, I don't know, you're sort of engaged a little bit more. So it's conceivable that would help. Because, I mean, I know for me, if I see something where the opening bid is, you know, $60 or something, I will just pass. I won't even put it, you know, I won't even put it in my watch list. I won't even think about it anymore.
Sure.
But I could imagine it being the case that if it were getting into the last seconds and it was like, you know, ticking up like 40, 50, 55, I might be willing to, in the spur of the moment at the end, you know, put it in for that much. So,
yeah. That's true.
I don't know.
Could be.
I don't know. Okay. Anyway, that's enough for me. So, Jack, what have you found?
I have found a couple of wacky items that are not actually computers at all, but are vaguely computer related. Because this is the kind of rabbit hole I always fall into on eBay, is just like finding like weird stuff. So one of these items that I found is, the full title of this item is 2012 Unisex Retro Trendy Pixel 8-Bit Glasses Pixelated Style Square Sunglasses. How about that? Nice. These are sunglasses.
2012,
but they're selling them right now. And they are sunglasses that from the front look sort of pixely, right? Like they're all sort of squared off and pixelated. Perfect for using together with your code bug when you're doing your Minecraft notifications, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And they come in a variety of colors and patterns. There is red and there's pink and yellow and white and black and patterns that cannot be described with words alone. You must actually just look at this to see the patterns, because one looks like some sort of cat or turtle creature or zebra or giraffe. Nice. I don't know. It could be anything, but it's still pixelated. It's truly a wonder to behold. And
the gray leopard one is out of stock.
Oh no, the gray leopard out of stock. It's too bad. Yeah. But the other ones that are in stock, they only cost $2.31. Which is amazing. And it's free economy international shipping from Hong Kong. This is not a like something out of somebody's closet. This is being sold, new product, I guess, from Hong Kong. And they ship everywhere for free. And they cost $2. Come on. Great for parties.
How do people I don't understand how they don't just like go out of business immediately.
I think it just must be volume. I bought some like off brand Nerf gun darts from a similar Hong Kong company, because they cost like a fifth of what they cost in the store here, including free shipping. It was absurdly cheap. Like, how could you not even buy it? Because it was like, because here in Sweden, like if you buy a pack of actual Nerf gun darts, like 12 of them cost like, I don't know, $15 or something. It's insane. And this place was selling a pack of, I think, 50 darts for about $5 and free shipping. It's just like, it's just so much cheaper. Like, and I guess they just, you know, because they are working out of Hong Kong, they don't care about any sort of licensing or branding or marketing. They just put their stuff on eBay and hope for the best. And I don't know. I guess they sell enough. It works.
Yeah. It's, I mean, you know, just trying to think about this in terms of like how the equivalent in coffees, you know, it's like, seriously, how, yeah. Well, so I might just skip on these. It says more than 10 available and 316 sold.
Yep.
So, cool.
Yep, there's a ton of those. And so the other thing that I found, the other wacky thing, regular listeners who've heard me pulling things from eBay before will have noticed that I'm often talking about belts. I don't know why I often end up on the belts. And I once again ended up in the belt section with an item that has a name that is totally crazy. The name of this has it, almost nothing to do with any kind of reality. It says iPhone FB Miss Atari Amiga 4/4S/5C. But what this actually is, it's a belt. It's a fabric belt with kind of a buckle. I don't know what to call this sort of buckle. It's kind of buckle that doesn't have, it's, you just slide the fabric through and wedge it shut onto it. Like there's not a, it's not a proper buckle with holes. I'm sure there's a term for this. Kind of like a military belt style buckle. But the belt, the cloth belt has little, it's a black belt with little green Space Invader figures on it. And on the belt near the buckle is a horizontally oriented iPhone holder. And this is crazy. So you, the idea is that you have this belt on and it's got little Space Invaders on it and you slide your phone into it with the screen facing outward for some reason. Like, who is going to see that phone? It's on your belt. You can't, it's not like, oh, my phone's ringing. Let's see who's calling me. Oh, no, I can't see because it's on my belt. I don't know. It's pretty wacky. And it looks like it's actually difficult to get the phone in and out because it's in this metal contraption. You have to slide back and forth. And the instructions are all in French. And the instructions include an image of showing the danger of putting the phone part on the back of your pants because it shows a purple like half circle showing the relative, I guess, like from all these directions, this is where something could impact your phone and create this bright orange yellow explosion of your phone on your pants. So don't do that. If you buy this belt, don't slide the phone back to the back because that will just, it will break your phone. Anyway, this thing costs a whole 10 euros and I could consider buying it but I would not use the actual iPhone holder, but just for a Space Invaders belt, I don't think it seems too bad.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I had a thing like a Palm Pilot holster.
Right.
At one point, which was a serious metal box.
Yeah.
But I
had one of those too, but for the Palm it was different because the Palm was not a network device. You never had to sort of like answer it. It never rang. There was never like, oh, wait, something's happening on this thing that I got to deal with now. You know, whereas a phone, it's like at any time that phone is going to, you know, you're going to get a message or it's going to ring or whatever. And it's like, okay, let's check this thing. Oh, I got to slide it out of this weird metal contraption. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, okay. So it's a Space Invaders belt.
With extras that you hopefully can just, I hope you can just easily remove that iPhone holder because that's just dumb.
It seems like, you know, if you can run some sort of emulator on it, so at least, you know, your belt can be playing some interesting Space Invaders game demo or something.
Here's what you do. You make a little animation containing little Space Invaders the same size as this, but perhaps moving horizontally across it. So you fire that up and you've got the coolest, you've got a belt with an animation on it.
Nice.
If you have an old iPhone 4 lying around you're not using, it becomes a nice sort of belt ornament. I think I'm going to buy this and keep that thing, find an old iPhone 4. I'll be the life of the party.
Yeah. All right. Well, report back on how it goes.
I just got to find the party to take it to, but
yeah,
some party somewhere.
So let's see. I guess that pretty much closes out the eBay portion of the show and the content portion of the show. I don't know. Do you any sort of like closing thoughts about your retro life?
This is your retro life. No, I don't.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I sort of feel like I just kind of like put in stuff all the way through here. So I never have anything new to say about like what's coming up on my horizon, except that, you know, I'm just going to sort some more stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. The only thing I ever have is that I'm always thinking about that I would like to get into a bit more 6502, which I've been doing a bit more of this year. I've been trying to follow my New Year's resolution and do some more 6502 assembly. And I've learned some things, and it's been fun, but I haven't made anything. There's still a month left. That's true.
Oh, I guess, yeah, we're coming up on the retro challenge warm-up, too.
Oh, right. I guess start thinking about that. I should try and do it this year. Because why not?
Indeed. Okay, so I guess we'll close it off there. So that will be it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this in the forums at vintage-computers.com/vcforum. We also have a new Facebook group, so if you want to go, you know, join the group and discuss all things RCR FB, feel free to do that. We will be happy to have you there. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast, and you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, and please, you know, write a review on iTunes. That'll help other people find the show. And with that, I guess, until next time,
Retro Compute.